KFSR presents First Ladies Focus, the personal stories behind people who love Fresno State. Featuring Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro, and KFSR Program Director, Julie Logan, 90.7 KFSR.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Julie Logan, along with my co-host, Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Julie.
Thanks for joining us this morning. We're excited to have another very special guest with us today. And as always, Mary has the introductions.
Well, thank you. Once again, we're very excited to welcome a guest that I don't even know how we're going to be able to do this in half an hour because just his bio alone goes beyond that. It's Dr. Thomas Loewenheim, and he is the award recipient for the 2016 Provost Award for Excellence in Teaching. Thank you for joining us today, Dr.
Absolutely,
Loewenheim.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here.
Of course.
Well, there is so much to cover, and I want to be able to talk about your family and your experience, but music has led you to have a very exciting and fulfilling life. You have traveled all over the world, and it appears as if you've been able to really follow a passion. Where did your love of music begin?
Well, that's a good question. Well, first of all, music was in my family throughout the history of times. And, you know, the closest to me were my grandparents, and they were both professional musicians, my mom's parents. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a violinist who studied with the famed Jene Hubai in Hungary and then went and performed all over the world, ended up in Israel. And my grandma was a phenomenal pianist, my mom's mom. She was from Vienna, and she was apparently the next big star who really, I mean, I read concert reviews from the time that she played and just to read that. And actually, an amazing story happened to me that when I was in a music festival in Austria, they invited one of the famous violin teachers. She was 90 at the time, and her name was Edith Steinbauer. Mm-hmm. And she remembered my grandma, which for me was just, you know, my mom and I. And of course, after the festival, we went to visit her in her home, which is actually two blocks away from my uncle, which is hilarious, all these little details. But to meet her, and she go like, I remember your grandma. She was the next big thing.
How
and then Second World War happened, and she had to run away. But that's the history that I come from. I remember my grandma, for example. The reason I'm not playing piano at all is because every time I get close to her Busendorf a piano, she'd hit my fingers. So like, that's only for professionals. So my mom gave me a cello instead.
I was going to ask you, how did you decide whether to go with a piano or with the violin or cello, or based upon pressure from one grandparent or the other? But you
my mom decided everything in our family. But I don't know if many people know, but I'm handicapped on both my legs, and I had several surgeries as a kid. And the cello is a great instrument. First of all, it's the most beautiful, and my mom was always in love with the cello, and she plays cello as well. But on top of it all, you get to sit down when you play the cello. Even when you play the hymn, everyone gets up, but the cellist stays seated. So I think that was one of the reasons she decided of it early on. Of course, it's the most beautiful instrument. And somehow, people are meant for their instruments. It's hard to explain it. And if not, then they will change it throughout their lives until they find. And they put the cello in my hand, and it goes like, yep, that's the instrument. But it wasn't an easy beginning. I wasn't one of those kids where, you know, at age four, they give you a cello, and I just practiced from that on. For me, it was actually a very different beginning, which I think why I can associate with my students very well. I was more of the stubborn kid that wanted to do everything else other than play the cello. So the numbers of times I quit between age 4 that I started and age 13, I think, when I really one day woke up and said that is something, is numerous times. And my mom even broke a shoe on my shoulder trying to make me practice. It's all true. And I always played cello, which was a great thing. But looking back, tell my mom, why didn't you make me practice more? And she go like, what else do you want to do? I broke a shoe on your shoulder, right?
Right. So,
but then when I was 13, something changed and I started to practice a lot more. And when I was 16, I woke up the day before my birthday. I remember that like it was yesterday. I had a dream, you know, one of those out of body experiences. At the time, I was in the number one class in the number one school in my country in Israel, which was meaning a lot. All my friends are either millionaires, billionaires, or heads of major computer companies and et cetera, working in high tech. And I remember I woke up that day and I told my mom, I was also on the national swim team and was practicing to become, and my life was basically 21 hours a day. I'd get up at 4:30 in the morning, go swim practice, then go to school at 7, be there until 2, then go home. And then from 3 to 8, I'd be in the pool. And then from 8 till 10, 11, I'd practice cello and then do homework from 11 to 1:30 and then get up for 4:30 again. And it didn't last for very much longer. That was 10th grade.
Well, now I see how you're able to fit all of the accomplishments that you have into your life because you learned how to really maximize the 24 hours in a day.
Right, because everyone, you know, I mean, you're doing all these things and you want to be the best at everything. Right. So it just takes that much time. And so then one day I just had my dream, and I remember it so vividly that I just had to be a cellist, and that was it. And I had the birthday party. My mom just for a little bit of background, my mom was an art therapist, a musician, and a psychologist, and my dad is an engineer. So our friends are obviously divided into the art people and the engineering people.
You had exposure to the both.
Oh, absolutely. And my dad was sure I'm going. He was so happy I was in this class because he's going to computer science. I was programming already at age 13 when most people in my hometown didn't have computers at the time.
Wow.
You know, at the time it was, I had a 16K computer.
Another,
and we put it together to a 32K, you know, and nobody had a 32K.
You doubled your capacity.
And my best friends, you know, who got this computer that we disassembled, and his mom comes on his birthday and sees us on the floor, and she was so upset. It was $2,000 at the time for a 16K computer, you know. But anyway, and I had this dream, and I remember my birthday party where all my dad's friends go to one side of the room yelling me that I'm, because I announced I'm going to art school and high school.
I announced it at the party,
and that was it. It was really important for me, and then all my mom's friends on the other side, and I was sitting in the middle,
They
were just screaming and shouting, you know, he's ruining his life, no, he's saving his life, no, he's going to be a great artist, and he's going to be just wonderful. And anyway, so that was that experience, but ever since really that day, that's when I started to practice 6-8 hours a day. I remember getting up at 4:30 instead of to the pool. I went to practice, and the discipline that you get from sports, if you can translate that into anything that you do, is really amazing. And that's why I love music. I love music so much because it basically takes all the disciplines that one needs. You need the physical discipline because you need to practice all these hours and you need to be very fit, and you need the mental activity to memorize, to learn, to analyze the pieces, to see things. There's a lot of numbers, and then of course the emotional side, which is the most satisfying one, because you're playing a happy movement and you're playing a sad movement, and it's philosophical because you're taking all these abstract dots and lines on a page and noises and trying to create a feeling and trying to create a mood and trying to transfer a message to people. And it's kind of very abstract overall, and trying to make it into something. It's very satisfying. I was talking to some parents the other day and during the final studio recital, and was saying, you know, one of the most intimidating things for people to do is talk in front of a large audience, right? But imagine yourself, you had to stand in front of a large, or sit in our case, in front of a large audience with a wooden box with four metal strings and a stick with horsehair on it and scratching those metal strings and trying to create art.
Beautiful music.
Speaking is so much easier compared with that. That for us cellists, the scariest thing is if you walk on stage and there's a chair and nothing else. So to try and play a Bach suite, which lasts anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes or solo recital like pianists do, at least pianists, I always tell them, at least you see a button and you can press. We don't even have those, But it's the abstract feeling of I'm going to stand in front of an audience for an hour and a half of a recital and play my music. That is so much, I think, more intimidating than just, of course, but to stand and speak, which we do from age zero, right? But again, if you don't have that to compare, then standing in front of a large audience and speaking is very intimidating, and to try and deliver a speech and be successful at that. But if you say or you have a pause, nothing happens. But for us, if we miss a note, everybody's like, it's the
notices.
End of the world. Everybody knows they missed a note, and etc. And it's the level and the expectation is so high.
You mentioned that every instrument has a personality, and matching that personality with the person who's going to play with it is vital in their success with playing the instrument. Do you feel that over the many years of practice and preparation, does your playing become more instinctive over time?
Absolutely, absolutely. But at the same time, I studied with one of the greatest teachers in the history of any instrument. Janos Starker was my teacher. Really, Mr. Starker, the one thing that he did, which is so amazing, is that he analyzed every single motion, every single action that we do as players into the tiniest detail. And with him, because we kept analyzing and breaking it into very small elements, then the system, while becoming instinctive, is also constantly checking and checking, so we don't develop a habit, so we come up with new ideas of how to do things better, so we can constantly monitor what we do so we don't regress. So actually the opposite. I mean, the most amazing thing about him would be that last time I saw him was in his 80s already.
Oh my goodness.
And he would still come up with new ideas, new fingerings, new ways of playing the instrument that were better and better, because it was always keep checking. Everything we do, it's keep monitoring, keep trying to do it better and better. And until the last day that he lived, he kept practicing and kept trying to come up with better and better ideas of how to do things better.
So perfecting technique was...
It's perfecting and becoming more efficient. It's also philosophical things, you know. I mean, doing a phrase better, coming up with a new fingering on a cello, one thing is to try and make it easier, but we use technique instead of just, you know, people think technique is how fast can you play. But for us, technique, all these decisions were actually a vocabulary, a musical vocabulary. And if you use one or another, is the larger your vocabulary, the better you are to express yourself, and the clearer the message comes across.
Makes sense.
everybody on a great day will play like God. And then comes the day where you're not so not having the best day. But you see, with this kind of a technique, even on your worst day, you're still at 99%. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're not 100, but you're 99. Whereas, you know, people who don't have that kind of assistant, on a bad day, they'll be at 85, which is not acceptable for a professional. And then a good day, everybody's going to be at 100. But to have this kind of idea, then you can keep evolving, keep progressing, mm-hmm. and keep refining your message to the smallest detail. And that makes life very satisfying. Of course, as a teacher, that is how I can help my students the best, because they will come and then I have this whole palette of, okay, let's check what you're doing wrong, or let's check what is not working perfectly, and then how can we find a solution? And that happens very quickly. And I'm trying to teach my students that kind of a method so they can then keep growing once they leave the studio, and then can keep growing once they're teaching. Mm-hmm. Because for me, first of all, you know, I'm teaching my students how to think, which is, I don't necessarily just give them solutions, but it's the famous thing, you give someone a fish or teach them how to fish, right? And this way they can become better by themselves, but they can also teach better and help their students with solving their problems. Basically, the main thing that I'm trying to do is problem solving, which is a great tool for no matter what you do.
Yes.
And if you learn to do it on the cello with my young students, I keep telling them, if you did that now with your homework, how much time would it take you to do homework? And they were like, well, a tenth of the time that it actually just repeat. And that is the main thing that I'm trying to teach my kids, is to think. These are the tools that you need for cello. But if you started using similar tools in any other field that you do, and you start thinking rather than just repeating, you know, in the day and age of the 21st century, where any piece of information is a cell phone away, why do we use so much time on just memorizing and spitting memories? It's much more important for us to teach today. This is the information. Now, what are we going to do with it?
Right. How to process
it. How to process it. How to understand it. What should we do? What shouldn't we do? You know, it's so much more important, because today we're in a day and age where basically we have already come to a concept we can almost do everything. Okay, how to get there is a different story, but really, I mean, as the human race, we can almost do everything. We went to the moon. I mean, we've duplicated ourselves. We have done DNA. We know the galaxy better than we've ever known. So it's not anymore as much. Of course, we still want to get more information and develop that, but it's so much more about what do we do with the information, I think, and the responsibility that we have as in the 21st century, not to use everything that we have. I hope they never use Tom bombs anymore, and I hope that they stop using guns as much as they do, and etc. Of course, if you need to, there's always cases where you need, but to start thinking, okay, now what am I going to do with all this information? That is so much more fascinating to me personally.
And part of building their confidence too.
Absolutely.
Confidence as a person, but as a musician.
Right.
When you're in the learning environments that you were in with people who were very elite players, did you experience seeing other musicians who were discouraged because they couldn't make the cut of the expectations of the professors? Or how were those professors able to encourage yet continue to get them to strive for the end goal without losing a person for and making them not love music?
I think that by the time you get to the top, like, I mean, in Mr. Starker's studio, it was very different. He was the hardest person on us anywhere because he said, if you can't survive me, you won't survive the real world. So if I make you quit, it's better. You have to understand, he was the greatest teacher. But when it comes to comments, you know, I mean, he would, I heard him say to a student, have you considered McDonald's? You know,
and
if you can survive that, then
really
okay. Then,
to the core.
Because when you get to the highest level, the people will tell you, and my conducting teacher, David Efron, said that the people that succeed in music are not necessarily the best, but are the ones that when they got up in the morning and they go like, if I didn't have music, I would die, or I cannot live without this. Those are the ones who have the most passion for it, and they will find the way to get there. I mean, even in our studio, there were people who quit because they go like, you know what, I really want to do that, and I'm not at the level, and I don't think I'll get there, so maybe I do something else. But again, and that's why I don't feel in the American system, it's very great to do music, even in as an undergraduate student or as a master's student, because then you can still go and do something else. You can do an undergrad in music and still do an MBA degree and go to a different, you can still go then to med school. You can still go and change your career path. In Israel or in Europe, it's harder because there, once you do your undergrad, it's expected that you continue. But of course, life is full of changes and people go in different directions. But again, the skills that music give are just so amazing. Responsibility, focus, ability to just sit in a room and focus on something for 8 hours to practice. I mean, anyone will hire you after that because I have a close friend. She's doing amazingly well in business. She was a second year student with Menachem Pressler at Indiana University. And she was immediately hired after 1 year of an MBA into a major, major company.
Oh.
And she went to her, the boss, and asked, why did you hire me? And she was like, are you kidding me? You were a student of Menachem Pressler's and you were in your second year of the doctoral program. That means if I need you to sit there for 10 hours, you will be able to sit, focus, and get a job done. And all the skills, the other skills I already mentioned.
Well, you're currently the head of strings and professor of cello. You're also the conductor of the university orchestra here at Fresno State.
Right.
And it's my understanding that you grew the orchestra quite significantly during your time here. How do you know when you have the right mix?
You don't know that you have the right mix. one of the great things and one of the difficulties about conducting any university orchestra or any university ensemble is that it keeps changing every year. So the great thing is that you get new people and sometimes it's better people and sometimes it's less experienced people. But that is the good part. The not so good part is in a professional orchestra, you hire the people and once they retire, you hire someone new and you have a pool to choose from. And then you work for many years and the ensemble becomes very good together because you've worked now for many years. And the change in such an ensemble like Chicago Symphony or San Francisco or New York Phil or LA Phil, again, the members don't change very frequently. I mean, they change, but not every year or every 2 years like they do in an ensemble like the University Orchestra. So you can grow that group and make them, you know, if you're talking about perfection, make them be very cohesive and like a giant family and they play very well. Mm-hmm. Of course, some people fight in a family and also that's for that can last for 30 years as well.
Oh my.
Right. But what is wonderful also is that in the University Orchestra is that the people are there to learn. So they actually really want to come and share their ideas and try and grow together. And by the end of the year, the orchestra is always way, way better than it was in September. Mm-hmm. And talking about the perfect mix, you make it the perfect mix. Mm. And that is, I think, what my big job is, to try and get everybody together and really focus. There's people on very, very different levels in the university orchestra because some people have been there already, you know, for 5-6 years doing a master's. Mm-hmm. And some people come with an experience where they've played in a youth orchestra. Other people come, never played in an orchestra before and suddenly in this environment. And I challenge the students. I mean, this year we did Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. This year was very challenging. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's to try and abridge. How do you take a group with such wide varieties of experiences and try and make them all play together? And that is the art. That is the really difficult things and difficult thing about conducting an orchestra, especially of such
a nature. It's a constant challenge.
It's a constant challenge. And every rehearsal is a challenge because some people are like, oh, that's too easy. Other people say that's way too hard. And to tell the students that it's really about what each individual learns. Uh-huh. And every individual is going to learn something different in the rehearsals. And the bottom line is, what did you learn? Did you learn another piece? Did you learn? Of course, the better people are in leading positions. The less experienced are going to sit more towards the back. But to see that eventually everybody gets it and everybody understand that it's really what I learned personally, but what we managed to achieve as a group.
Together.
And I have to be very patient towards all my friends and help them out. And actually this year, I don't know if for the first time, but for the most, I saw people really taking the leadership positions in much more serious way, organizing sectionals, getting together, helping their friends. Uh-huh. And this, when this moment happens, when everybody goes like, you know what, we have a concert in 2 weeks, and I better help my friends be the best.
Pull it together.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the growth within each and individual member in the orchestra, that just breaks my heart. To come to the concert and in a good way, right? To come to the concert and see members that at the concert they pull it together and manage to do something that on the first rehearsal, you know, tears were in their eyes and go like, there's never any way I can learn this 25-page piece in 4 weeks.
And you see them accomplish it.
They do it. And they have done tremendous work this year. I mean, really, that's what makes it so worth it is, you know, you can give kids cookies, you can give them an A, you can give them whatever. But to see any, and I call, you know, my 20-some-year-old students still my kids, right?
Right.
But to see that smile in their eye at the end of a concert that they have accomplished something, that they learned something, they've managed to do something they never thought they could, that is for me the biggest award. No award can do anything other than that moment. And being in my position as the conductor of the orchestra, it's a very unique position because I get to get almost students from all the studios in the Department of Music and get them together to produce this incredible program. And the orchestra has just done miracles with that. It's really a big honor, actually.
It also sounds like it takes a lot of patience.
It takes a lot of patience and a lot of work. And I thought that after 9 years at Fresno State, I'm going to be at the stage where like everybody knows the orchestra is wonderful. Everybody knows people will just flock to it.
It should be running itself by now.
If you don't take care for 5 minutes, it's like, we don't know what's going to happen next. So it's constant work. And you talked about building the program. The university used to have a wonderful orchestra program 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then for some reason, it just didn't. Mm. And to be able to come and put it back together and recruit the students and to get everybody to be on board. My colleagues have been very supportive and be really great and try to make sure that it maintains itself. Because I'll come to them and they're like, that's it, I'm done. There's no way I can do this anymore. And they're like, no, we really want it to continue. So let's try and find what is. Because it's very difficult and it's constant work and one has to wear many hats and to put the programs together and put the season together and then get the students and sometimes you don't have enough students to try and recruit from outside and make sure that the program runs smoothly and get the music and etc. It's many hours of work, but it's very, very fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And I think that it puts our music program and our university at a very definitely state, national, and in a way now with our projects, our summer project and our international festivals for all the instruments, it really puts us on a higher level.
A different tier.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And to have, for example, for the cello festival, which I'm running, mm-hmm. to have doctoral students from major universities come here and have international artists come here for a week-long masterclasses, sessions, wonderful. Concerts. It's just really amazing to see what we can put together mm-hmm. at Fresno State.
Fantastic.
You know, I mean, when I first came here, everybody was laughing at me for coming to Fresno, you know, out of all places. And now people have even moved here to teach, and we've built the program.
They didn't know the jewel we have here.
They don't. Many people in Fresno don't know the jewel we have here, right. Which is one of the things I hope the radio station, you know, will help us with, you know.
Yes.
And every TV and every concert we do, more and more people are mm-hmm. aware. But it really puts us on the map, on the positive map of Fresno, which now I'm really excited that people want to come to Fresno, mm-hmm. not just because, you know, we have great corn, right. or not just because we're on the way to Yosemite, but
sure.
because we have something.
The strength of the program.
Right, exactly.
I'd like to talk to you about the process you go through when you're selecting pieces for a program, because I would think that for someone with your years of experience and exposure, that's like trying to select a drop of water out of the ocean. How, out of the vast availability of music and styles, do you hone in on a piece or a group of pieces to work together for a performance?
It's actually even harder than you imagine. I have a huge book that lists almost all the pieces written for orchestra or all the major. It's like 100, it's like 500, 600 pages, and it's huge.
Wow.
And it lists all the orchestration. Choosing the pieces for the university orchestra is very hard, or any orchestra that I conduct, the youth orchestras as well, because on one hand, you want to include as many people, mm-hmm. and we have a large, very strong percussion. We have great brass. So when you use a large orchestra, which uses lots of brass and winds and percussion, then usually the level of difficulty is very high, because in the classical and early romantic periods they didn't use a large sections.
Okay.
And then when music written later throughout the history in the 20th century or even 21st century, it's usually very demanding technically.
Mm-hmm.
So if I choose a piece that's too demanding technically and it has too large of an orchestration, then again it backfires because we don't have enough time to prepare it, or it's too technically demanding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very sensitive how to choose the right pieces. And it's even more hard because right now I don't know what students I'm going to have next year. So how do you hypothetically choose a program that hoping that the students will come
balance.
And that's right. So it's very challenging, but at the same time, I'm trying to choose something that will be interesting,
mm-hmm.
interesting for the students, challenging, not overwhelmingly so, interesting for the audience, of course,
yes.
pieces that I love and care about. So far, I actually almost haven't repeated any pieces in 9 years, which is rare, but the literature
wow.
is so vast.
That's quite an achievement.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really a puzzle that sometimes I leave some things open mm-hmm. and sometimes I will change programs based on what we have. But it's very challenging because of all the things I just mentioned to try and come up with a program. With a professional orchestra, a conductor will say, this is what I would like to conduct and I think it's going to work well with the mm-hmm. audience. And then you hire the people to match. With us, we have the people, we have the technical advantages and deficiencies, and trying to put pieces that, you know, especially at the beginning of the semester, that are not too demanding. Also, with our season, it changes to football season. We're trying to make sure that we don't, you know, have the people be on a field and then run to an orchestra concert at the mm-hmm. same evening. So we're trying to work together, and Steve McKeith and I have a great working relationship, and I'm really happy about that. We're trying to make sure that the students aren't overwhelmed as well. But that creates sometimes, you know, where you have only 4 weeks to work on one program and then 8 weeks to work on the second program. So
mm-hmm.
that will then mean that we'll choose an easier program for the first and then a more demanding for a second. So those are the difficulties in finding
And you
finding
don't know
that.
If you've made the right decisions until
you,
the performance.
You know it after the concert. But so far, I must give the students the I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, but they have done it each and every time.
Yes.
They came through, and the audience, I mean, really, we've gotten so many standing ovations, which is always mm-hmm. heartwarming. And of course, we have a very supportive audience, but really to see, I mean, our last concert, I mean, it was, is it going to happen or not? Shostakovich's 10th symphony is over and is an hour long. And the mental challenge and the technical challenge, and it goes from these large sections where everybody's playing together, and suddenly, you know, one instrument by all by themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just so nerve-wracking for the students, because mm-hmm. suddenly you're a soloist after
right.
playing this, you know, 75 people playing the loudest they can, and suddenly one instrument alone. And it just, all the focus goes on them. But really, they have done unbelievable work, and I'm really proud of them.
Oh,
I'm really, really
great.
Proud of them.
I'd like to talk about your family. Your wife, Jidon Shin, she's also a musician.
She also plays a little bit, but she's actually a professor of linguistics here at Fresno State.
Okay.
And her area is child language acquisition, Mandarin Chinese, and she's one of the top people in the world doing that, and she has papers published. And now she's kind of like looking at multi-language acquisition because of our kids. Because our kids have been exposed to so many languages since age zero, so she talks to them in Chinese. I speak to them in Hebrew. Together they hear English all the time because that's a common language. And now Emmanuel is in the dual immersion program
with
your son. Right, exactly. So he speaks Spanish, and to him, we're all his R's. It's just unbelievable. So he's teaching our little son how to speak Spanish, which is amazing. He loves to teach.
That's
so he's
great.
Teaching him all the numbers, and he says uno, dos, tres, and etc. But then he goes to colors, and he teaches Rafael to say colors. So he says, say rojo, and Rafi says rojo. And we're like, no, rojo, rojo, roll your R and the jo. And it's just amazing. So they're ready at four languages. And then grandma speaks to them in German when she comes to visit too. So they're exposed to all these languages, and they love opera. So we did Carmen a couple of years ago. So they're singing. It's amazing to see them. We're driving home. They still love Carmen the most, you know. So they sing in French in the car, and they don't even know it's French, but they can sing it and they pronounce it so well. So they have a really good ear, and they're very musical. They've been singing since age zero because they've been exposed to it all the time.
I love to see that they attend your performances. Tell us about the FUSA Phil at Disney Hall in LA.
Right.
What is that project?
So FUSA is a program that started because when Summer Arts left 5 or 6 years ago, it left a big void, and the dean called me and said, can you put a program together? And we just basically took members of the youth orchestras, and we took members from the Fresno State Orchestra and the opera, and we put everything together and decided to have a concert in Disney Hall in the middle, and then produce two operas. We did Pagliacci and Cavalleria, and Scott Piper came, and Laura Peterson, who's coming back this summer to sing the Mahler with us, is coming back, and Tony Redford, and all of us just got together and rehearsed from 9 till 6 every day, and then produced two operas and a concert in Disney Hall, and that was 5 years ago, I think. And this year, it evolved throughout the years. Then we did a year of just strings, and then we did, last year was a full symphony orchestra with faculty. What we felt was missing was the instruction, the one-on-one instruction. And now we have assembled a giant faculty from all over the world, over 20 faculty members, and we have two programs. We have a half-day program, which is mainly meant for local kids because it meets from 9 to 1 every day, and it works with special faculty for that. And we also have the graduate students who are now attending the full-day program. They come and assist for 1 to 2 hours every day with a half-day program. So our local kids, and that really, and it evolved into, we have something called the Accent on Access program in town. It works in a couple of schools, Edison Bethune and Madison, where they go 4 days a week. Next year, we'll change the format a little bit, but it gives really the access. And that's the main point, is that anyone who wants to do it can come. So our half-day program now is any kids, from very advanced kids up to junior high and high school, but even young. We have kids age 5 all the way up to high school who are not at the level to play at the full symphony orchestra that are going to come, and it's accessible to everyone to attend.
And they can build their skills, get scholarships.
And yeah, they have instruction for 2 hours in the morning and then a chamber orchestra in the afternoon. It's only strings this year.
What an opportunity.
It is an incredible opportunity because it gives our students an opportunity to teach. And it gives these kids an opportunity to have lessons every day for 2 weeks, for 2 hours, and then play in an orchestra.
That's magnificent.
And then the full day program has attracted this year the highest level students we've ever had. It is graduate students from all over the world and undergraduate students and very few, but very talented high school and actually a few, even elementary kids, but it's like we're talking about 3 or 4 who can play Mahler's Second Symphony. The piece that we chose this year is one of the most challenging pieces in the literature, both technically, but even more so musically. The piece lasts an hour and a half.
Oh my.
There's one little break in between, but really just to breathe. The first movement alone is over 30 minutes long. It's almost 35, almost 40 minutes long.
You really need some physical conditioning.
You need mental and physical. It's very challenging, but it's philosophically, it's called the resurrection. And it has many, many meanings that Mahler put in there. It even involves two soloists, a soprano and an alto, and a choir. So for our concert in Disney Hall, which is June 24th at 8 p.m., it's again, one of the things we're very proud of. We had a lot of support from Granville Holmes this year, from the president's office, the provost's office, the dean's office, and several other, the Bonner Foundation and several other donors to try and make it come together, because the orchestra is over 100. It's almost 120 members large, plus 70 members in the choir, and the two soloists to try and produce this piece in Disney Hall. And it's, for us, us, we're very proud of it because here we are, Fresno, and we're taking a project that we're doing here at the university and with the youth orchestras and with all the support from Fresno. Mm-hmm. And last year we took a composition that was written here by Dr. Benjamin Boone. Yes. And this year we're really focusing on this Mahler Symphony No. 2 because we wanted to give the students this experience to play this piece. It's not something that one gets to do every day.
Right.
And thank only you. Professional orchestras usually can put such a thing, or major, major universities. And even they stay away from that because of the physical. But mm-hmm. here we are taking it to Los Angeles and, mm-hmm. and performing it there. And we hope that all our alums will come and that all our connection will generate a nice audience. The concert is free, which is something we're really, really proud of, because if you just want to go and see Disney Hall, you have to pay $5 or $10 ticket to just see the hall. And there you can come and see the hall and attend a concert. And the faculty, like I mentioned, is unbelievable. And the students this year are really top-notch students. We have from Czechoslovakia, from Venezuela, from Puerto Rico, from all over the United States. It's just something that we're really proud of to be able to offer here in Fresno. And I really hope that we can sustain this festival mm-hmm. because it does cost a lot of money to do it. Mm-hmm. But again, what it produces for that money is 10-20-fold. Mm-hmm. And to do it here in Fresno, my dream is to one day that, you know, people in the music say, they say Aspen, they say Tanglewood, they'll say Fresno.
I like that.
That's a dream. Let's see if it's a matter of can we sustain it or not,
right.
and in the format and et cetera. But it's beyond worth it for, I think, the whole city of Fresno to be able to host such a festival,
yes.
to have this kind of caliber students and faculty come here. Of course, it generates an audience. And then for us to be able to take and present something so positive in LA, in the home of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and the waves have already been felt. I mean, you'll be surprised how people know about Fresno all over the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had students apply that just heard about it, which is just amazing for us. And for example, last year, Julia Copeland, the executive director of the Youth Orchestras and of FUSA as well, and me went and gave a presentation at the AXO Festival, which is Association of California Symphony Orchestras. And we made a presentation together with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, with their YOLA, which is the Youth Orchestra Project. And we gave a presentation together and talked about this project. And to have Fresno talk together with the LA Philharmonic and make a presentation, it's such an honor.
Yeah,
and then next year,
that's a testament to the strength of the program.
Absolutely. And the university and everything that mm-hmm. we do here, and the youth orchestras, of course. And since we're doing all these projects and everything is coming together, this year the Los Angeles Youth Orchestra is coming to Fresno to make a presentation together with the Youth Orchestra of Fresno in the Saroyan Theater in October. So it's like evolving and evolving and evolving. And mm-hmm. if we can sustain and maintain that, I think it will really put Fresno as an empire of music making. It has already, but if mm-hmm. we can continue
it's
and make
keep
it
growing.
Even more, right? It's really amazing.
Well, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for sharing your expertise and your passion for music with our students and with the community, and for being bold enough to think about other ways that you can engage the community and foster the love of music in young children that we hope will end up being Fresno State students.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a big honor and it's a great pleasure, and really how symbiotic it all became that our community is now part of our music program. And we just finished our 65th anniversary of the Youth Orchestras of Fresno concert, and to have 50 alums come and perform with the orchestras, and to finish it with 350 students from our three orchestras, the accent program, I mean,
all of them
playing this Bach piece, the last chord was just shaking the
Saroyan,
and it was huge, but so worth it. And now with this FUSA program coming up June 12th through the 26th, with the concert on June 24th, and then our final concert here at Fresno State on the 26th. And it's important to mention that we're going to have student concerts and faculty concerts and a competition throughout the entire week. So check the web pages,
okay.
Just Google FUSA or just go fusamusic.org.
And we'll have those links available
absolutely.
On our website so that people can click straight to it and get
right.
more information.
And then make sure you come to all our concerts next season too. It's amazing to see. I try very hard. Of course, you personally too, but also all the listeners and
yes,
the audience in
yes.
town. And I wish that the student body knew more what we do so they could enjoy it, because if you go to a concert, it can become expensive. Whereas here, the youth orchestras offer everything for free. And of course, the university orchestra offers for really $5 for students and etc. So it's just really
and
wonderful.
It's great exposure too to a type of music that they may not have ever heard before.
Right, and that is why we're very proud of it. It's very sophisticated. It used to be elitistic, which I don't think it is. We should be able to share it with everyone, and having it here on campus for our students, the number of activities that the Department of Music does is over, I think, 100 to 200 concerts a year that we produce throughout all our ensembles and everything. And that is just wonderful to be able to just walk on campus and hear such wonderful performances.
Well, thank you again for joining us, and we will be spreading the word about all these great concerts coming up.
Wonderful, and thanks for having me here again.
Thanks again to our very special guest, Fresno State Department of Music, Head of Strings, Professor of Cello, and Conductor of the University Orchestra, and recipient of the 2016 Provost Award for Excellence in Teaching, Dr. Thomas Loewenheim. And of course, my co-host, Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro. Thanks for joining us this morning, and please join us again next Sunday morning at 10 for another First Ladies Focus on KFSR. We're on the air at 90.7 FM and streaming worldwide at www.kfsr.org.
KFSR presents First Ladies Focus every Sunday morning at 10. For a complete program schedule, visit kfsr.org.